3, 2, 1.
What will the world look like 10 or 20 years from now? The Wall Street Journal's Future of Everything podcast is here to give you a peek. And we can't wait to show you what's coming. Subscribe now.
Russia and Ukraine battle in the Donbas region amid concerns of a worsening global food crisis.
It is the country's industrial heartland and has some of its richest agricultural land. So while the pace of change is slow, what is happening is still enormously significant.
Plus, key results from yesterday's California primaries and international air travel is back. It's Wednesday, June 8th. I'm Luke Vargas with the Wall Street Journal. Here's the AM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories moving your world today. Russia's lengthening war in Ukraine will lead to a near doubling of inflation rates in rich countries this year and will threaten food shortages in poorer countries, according to a new report by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, or OECD. Journal reporter Ben Dummett says OECD officials are now urging governments to take steps to blunt the war's effects.
The OECD is recommending that policymakers focus on addressing the food shortages that threaten many countries in Africa and the Middle East. This may require cooperation on international aid and in the area of logistics of shipping and distributing to countries in need.
Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov began talks with Turkish officials today toward a possible deal to create a sea lane to export grain from Ukraine as part of a UN-backed effort to address a global food crisis. The potential agreement would involve Turkish warships demining Ukrainian ports and creating a safe passage for ships carrying wheat and other products across the Black Sea. We'll have more on the war in Ukraine later in the show. Turning to the U.S., votes are still being counted in a number of primary elections held in 7 states yesterday. California held a number of closely watched contests. In San Francisco, voters recalled reform-minded District Attorney Chesa Boudin, who was accused of being too soft on crime. In a forceful speech Tuesday night, Boudin said he was proud of the reforms he enacted.
Voters were not asked to choose between criminal justice reform and something else. They were given an opportunity to voice their frustration and their outrage, and they took that opportunity.
Meanwhile, in Los Angeles, real estate developer Rick Caruso, who tapped into voter frustration over a persistent homelessness crisis and rising crime, will face Congresswoman Karen Bass in a November runoff to be the city's next mayor. We've got more details on yesterday's primaries around the U.S. on WSJ.com. And a group led by Walmart heir Rob Walton has agreed to buy the NFL's Denver Broncos for $4.65 billion, according to a person familiar with the matter. The deal shatters the record for the price of a North American sports team, which was previously about $2.3 billion. The team announced the agreement late Tuesday without disclosing the price. The sale, which is still pending league approval, settles one of the NFL's most tumultuous ownership situations. International air travel is back. That is the update from WSJ Global Aviation reporter Ben Katz, who's reporting that new data shows booking for foreign travel is approaching pre-pandemic levels. And Ben joins us now with the details. Hi, Ben.
Hi.
All right. So what have you learned about foreign travel demand as it currently stands?
So we asked for a bit of data on what U.S. outbound traffic was looking like. So that's kind of specifically U.S. international travel leaving the States. This is data provided by Forward Keys, which is an aviation data analysis company. They found that bookings are currently sitting at about 97% of where they were in 2019. So almost on the cusp of where we were pre-pandemic. And obviously that's kind of split depending on what region you look at. So the Caribbean has actually outperformed. So they're sitting at about 109% ahead of where we were in 2019. South America, 95%. Europe is slightly low, 93%. The only region really that's struggling or kind of still lagging is Asia Pacific, where they're sitting at about 62% of where we were in 2019. And really that's led by China's zero COVID policy and the travel restrictions associated with that.
And what does this mean more broadly for the travel industry?
So there was always kind of a big question mark over when international travel would really recover. Domestic travel we saw in the US start to recover already in 2020, intra-European travel similar, Chinese domestic travel before kind of the COVID jump was also recovering and doing particularly well. What was always kind of the question is international travel in the face of travel restrictions, you know, COVID-related, pandemic-related, vaccine requirements, testing requirements, these kind of things. And what we're really seeing now is people being at home for the last 2 years, they want to get out, they want to get back to the trips that they used to do. And really, the industry is happy to have it. This summer is going to be critical for airlines, for airports, just in terms of recovering some of the losses that they booked over the last 2 years.
I'm sure the industry is glad not to have empty airplanes, but can they actually keep up with the current level of demand?
Well, exactly. And there is this question mark of how prepared the airlines have really been. And what we're seeing in Europe, for example, in the UK over the Queen's Jubilee weekend, that was the last 4-day long weekend, kind of major disruption at airports, queues stretching out into parking lots. There's shortages of staff, that's security staff, that's check-in staff, that's pilots and cabin crew. All airlines, airports, as they try to ramp back up to this 2019 level of capacity. So the industry is definitely facing this pressure point at the moment to, you know, just how quickly they can get back to these pre-pandemic travel levels.
So I guess it's not all blue skies ahead necessarily for the airline industry, despite all the demand they're seeing.
Yes. I mean, at the moment, we're dealing with record inflation levels and also record fuel prices. And the airlines don't really know how long that's going to last. And that's really being put onto the consumer. Airfares are some of the highest they've been in a long time. And there is that kind of push and pull as to we want to fill our aircraft, but also we want to make profits.
That was Wall Street Journal global aviation reporter Ben Katz. Ben, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, Russian and Ukrainian troops are locked in an intense battle over territory in Ukraine's eastern Donbas region, and the stakes for both sides are high. We'll have that story after the break.
What then will the future reveal?
There's one thing we know about the future. It's being built now.
We all have a stake in the future.
The future.
The future.
The future.
And the Wall Street Journal's Future of Everything podcast is here to give you a glimpse of what's on the way. I'm Danny Lewis. Join us as we dig into how science and technology are shaping the future.
For that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives.
Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Wall Street Journal Brussels Bureau Chief Dan Michaels is reporting that both Ukraine and Russia have increasingly higher stakes at play in the war in Ukraine, despite the fact that the amount of territory changing hands in the eastern Donbas region has slowed. And Dan joins us now with more. Hi, Dan. Thanks for being with us.
Good to be with you.
So the pace of gains seems to have slowed down, but does that mean the stakes are any lower?
Absolutely not. If anything, the stakes are higher now, in large part because the early phase of the war was unsuccessful for the Russians. So now they have to prove that they can accomplish something. The pace of battle has slowed significantly because Russia has realized that its initial approach of trying for a lightning strike was unsuccessful, and it now has to take a more traditional, slow approach. And so they are methodically and brutally advancing. As a senior NATO official who I spoke with said, the Russians are only making slow incremental gains, but they're making slow incremental gains, and the territory is significant. So while the pace of change is slow, what is happening on the battlefield is still enormously significant.
And this territory that's at stake here, Dan, is pretty important, is it not?
It's very important because the area, Donbas in eastern Ukraine, is the country's industrial heartland and has some of its richest agricultural land. So it is really vital, not just to Ukraine, but to the world, because as most people probably know now, Ukraine is an enormous producer of agricultural products, and it feeds not just itself, but many, many other countries. Russia is blockading the Black Sea, stopping those shipments from leaving Ukraine and getting to countries in the Middle East and Africa, where food crises are very much a concern and a problem right now.
Let's talk about the specific stakes for both sides here, starting with Russia. What test is the battle in the Donbas really posing for them?
The test for Russia is essentially, can they succeed in capturing and holding ground in Ukraine. They started this war thinking they could quickly decapitate the Ukrainian government, that President Zelensky, who was a former television actor, a comedian, I think few people in the Kremlin or in Russia imagined he would have the tenacity, the grit, the courage that he's had to hold on and challenge former KGB official now in charge of Russia. So there's that almost personal level to it. And the Russian army was long considered the world's second best military. So the fact that they put so many resources into the opening phase of the war and accomplished so little really kind of adds pressure to show something for the enormous cost that this war is having on Russia, both in materiel and lives. That's something that in some ways maybe gets less attention, but the cost to Russia in lives of what they're doing, their soldiers, is enormous. And sooner or later, the pressure inside Russia will mount, and Putin has to be able to say that he's accomplished something.
And what is on the line for Ukraine, besides obviously not wanting to lose territory?
Yeah, obviously. Survival is the first thing, and saving Ukrainian lives. So that goes without saying. Second is holding and taking back Ukrainian territory. The first challenge for the Ukrainians is to show that they can stop Russia's advance. A bigger challenge may be to dislodge the Russians and push them back, first to where they were before February 24th when they started this attack, and then maybe even back further. Beyond this, there's an element for President Zelensky and Ukrainian leadership to show Western allies that they can succeed in this Herculean task that 3 months ago nobody would have thought possible. Ukraine is being supplied with the vast majority of its weaponry, of its ammunition, is coming from Western allies. Ukraine needs these supplies. And some Western governments are a bit wary because of the geopolitics here, relations with Russia, and concerns that Ukraine may not ultimately have a chance of succeeding in their goal. And so maybe it would be better to push for diplomacy, if not immediately, then to ensure that if the negotiations resume, that at least there is an opening for some kind of diplomacy with Russia.
And Dan, how do you interpret European officials this week accusing Russia now of weaponizing Ukrainian food supplies?
This is a huge issue right now, not just in Europe, but the United States, because it's a worldwide issue. There are discussions about how to get grain out, either to open up lanes in the Black Sea where mines are taken away, or by land, train routes. And there are all kinds of problems with this because the former Soviet Union used a different train gauge than the West. So sending train shipments is slow and complicated. There's discussion of maybe shipping by train from Ukraine through Belarus to a port in Lithuania. All of these countries were parts of the Soviet Union and so used the same rail gauge. The problem is that Belarus and its leader, Alexander Lukashenko, are very close to Russian President Putin. So it's probably a non-starter, but I guess it's a sign of the level of desperation and concern about the food crisis that people are even willing to entertain some kind of deal with such a close Putin ally to get food to the world.
That was Wall Street Journal Brussels Bureau Chief Dan Michaels. Dan, thank you as always for the update.
Thank you for having me.
And finally, while workers in other countries embrace lunchtime get-togethers, many American workers aren't taking lunch breaks and are left grabbing mouthfuls on the go and left eating at their desks. WSJ Work and Life columnist Rachel Feinsig explains why so many in the U.S. struggle to preserve the sacred lunch break.
I think we're just not good at it here in the States, especially. I also think in this moment, people have just gotten so used to having back-to-back meetings, Zoom calls, especially if you're still working remotely, if you're hybrid, you're not kind of getting those cues from other people that they're getting up and going to lunch, and it's an acceptable thing that everyone needs to eat. And it becomes almost this invisible need where you're just supposed to kind of power through and pretend like you don't have human needs while you have these back-to-back Zoom calls.
And that's What's News for Wednesday morning. We'll be back tonight with a new show. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening, and have a happy lunch.